TED Audio Collective.
Blockchain, NFTs, AI. What does this mean for you and me? I'm Sherelle Dorsey, host of the TED Tech Podcast, where we bring you the latest innovations and biggest ideas in tech. Tech is evolving fast and it affects our lives, from the metaverse to the watches on our wrists. You'll learn why people in AI make good business partners, about our future self-driving robo-taxi, what the next generation of Siri, Alexa, Google looks like, and a lot more. Find TED Tech on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Hey everyone, it's Adam Grant. Welcome back to Rethinking, my podcast on the science of what makes us tick with the TED Audio Collective. I'm an organizational psychologist, and I'm taking you inside the minds of fascinating people to explore new thoughts and new ways of thinking. My guest today is Ian Bremmer. He's a political scientist and my favorite thinker on geopolitics. And I have a lot of questions for him about the state of the world.
I expect that we're not just like straight on talking about geopolitics, right? You're interested in methodology. You're interested in strategy. You're interested in how people think the way they do. So my assumption is that you have a hook that is adjacent to my day-to-day expertise and not directly on them.
You know me too well, Ian.
Am I right?
Too well.
Am I right?
Yeah. We're going to be 30 degrees off anything you're fully qualified to speak on. That's my goal.
That's awesome.
As the founder and president of Eurasia Group, Ian runs research and consulting projects to help leaders understand and manage geopolitical risk. He also hosts G-Zero World, a show on PBS, and he gave the most popular TED Talk of all of 2023. So I thought it was time to get his help making sense of the mess the world is in. You have single-handedly changed my interest in geopolitics. You've increased it.
I was going to say, if it had been high before and now it's non-existent, I was going to be, damn.
The floor was low, let's be clear. It has climbed. And I have to tell you, I find this annoying.
Which part?
The fact that I'm now more interested in geopolitics than I used to be, because I feel like for most of my adult life, I've made it a principle to avoid things that are low control and high stakes.
Yeah.
So like I love watching sports, even though I can't influence the outcome, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter.
It's low stakes. It's great. I know.
Yeah.
Like 5 minutes after the game is over, I don't care. And I love that about sports.
But your world, I hate, because when I start to wonder about what's going on in Russia and Ukraine or what President Xi is going to do in China, I mean, they matter to the world. I care about the world. And so I don't want to pay attention to things that matter that I can't influence. And so I feel like you've made my life a little bit worse, even though you've made me a lot more informed.
A lot of things about the way the world works are actually up for grabs. And they will be determined not just by a small group of government actors who have their finger on the button, because governments are increasingly incapable by themselves of driving a lot of that change. And that's a time that is sort of rife, not just with danger, but also with the ability to have individual impact. So yeah, I would say that someone like you, who would have been nearly irrelevant to geopolitical outcomes, influencing them in the late 20th century, when we're in the Cold War, has much more ability to engage with what the next 10, 20 years of geopolitics will bring, because it's going to be a diffusion of actors, some of whom you are much more connected with, some of whom you have a lot more influence over, and also because social movements are going to matter more. We don't yet know what the new ideologies are that will drive how power is distributed around the world. Right now, there's almost an absence of it. I think someone like you having a little bit more at stake in the future of geopolitics of our little planet, this is the right time for you to be more engaged. And part of my role is to make that happen. I'm one of these people that tends to think that you appreciate the good things in your life by not insulating yourself from real things in the world that are challenges. I think that those good things you appreciate more. So in that regard, I suspect this is also good for Adam, but you might not feel that way.
I always think of the astronaut who came back, I think it was in the 70s, and said, looking out from space, like, there are no borders. Like, countries are a human fiction, and you just want to grab politicians and shake them and say, look at that, you bastard. And I think I've always felt that way about geopolitics. You love thinking about how the world could work better. And there's a part of me that thinks, like, but do you really want to get into the weeds of these people who are causing the world to work worse? How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, I find people endlessly fascinating. I don't actually love thinking about classical international politics with, like, you know, sort of very, very traditionally run small groups of diplomats and small groups of generals who, you know, sort of essentially are moving pieces on the table. The dynamics in the world today are so much more complex, fast-moving, fluid than that.
You've said that 2024 is the Voldemort of years.
It's a horrible year, yeah.
Where are you on this? Are you at all optimistic?
The reason why this is the Voldemort of years is because the most powerful country in the world is experiencing a crisis of democracy. So there's one election that's really important and deeply problematic. And then beyond that, we also have these two major wars that are going on that are not heading in a direction that most, certainly most democratic actors are happy with at all. And any one of those things in the last 25 years would have made you stand up and take notice. All three at the same time, really bad. So geopolitically, yeah, 2024 is pretty god-awful.
I feel like one of the things I've really had a hard time processing, both as a psychologist and a human being, is this pendulum swing between Chicken Little, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, there's a constitutional crisis, land wars for the first time in generations, like the world is falling apart. And on the other hand, being in the movie Don't Look Up and just being completely ignorant of the reality in front of us. How do you think about finding the accurate balancing point between those two extremes?
I see geopolitics as something that's quite cyclical. It's just that the cycles are long. There are, you know, all sorts of counteracting and balancing forces that exist. You get out of equilibrium and you get pushed back to equilibrium. You experience a power vacuum and actors want to come into that vacuum. You have institutions that start to break down and there are new reasons to have new institutions or to reform them. Things start breaking. You have a big crisis. And then suddenly everyone pays attention and you work to resolve the crisis. Now, in the global economy, we have those things happen all the time. They're called recessions, right? You've got bust cycles. Things blow up. And they happen so often that we have a whole industries of economists and people that serve them and align with them that have definitions of what a technical recession is at the country level and at the global level. And we have fiscal and monetary tools and how to respond to a recession. And those tools exist whether you are a Chinese economist or a European economist or an American economist, right? Now, in geopolitics, there are also cycles, but because those cycles are long and slow-moving cycles, we don't recognize them as cycles. And in particular, the bust cycle of geopolitics, which we are in right now, is one where the balance of power no longer relates to the institutional framework that you have. And so when you think about a lot of the institutions that we have today, which were set up in the aftermath of World War II, today's European Union, which is the aftermath of the European Economic Community that was originally set up, or the WTO, which is kind of what the logical outcome of the GATT process was set up with the United Nations and the Security Council. Like, those institutions no longer reflect the global balance of power at all. And that is bringing us into what I would call a geopolitical recession, a bust cycle. And that's why we are seeing a lot more things break. The United States is still the most powerful country, but for many reasons doesn't want to be the global policeman or the architect of global free trade, doesn't want to drive globalization, and certainly doesn't want to promote and expand democracy all over the world. And yet no other country or group of countries is prepared to step into America's shoes. And that is this cyclical downturn that we're presently experiencing that will create snapback functions to bring us to a new equilibrium, but it is going to take time. And so if you needed to be between Chicken Little and Don't Look Up for the next few years, are going to need to be a little more chicken and a little less head in the sand.
It's totally fascinating to think about a geopolitical recession. And I think that that language actually helps me understand, hey, wait a minute. If you look over the course of history, this is something we've seen before. It has patterns, and the causes look different today on the surface, and they're different technologically and socially, but they probably have some underlying similarities to the causes of the past. I guess where your optimism is striking to me is you're saying this is a cycle, and it will snap back, but we're going to have to take action to cause it. And you're saying that that action requires actually not a level of doom and gloom, but sounding the alarm.
Yeah. And of course, we've already seen that in one area of geopolitics. It's manifest in climate, where we didn't have any institutions that existed to manage climate. And we had a whole bunch of very powerful individuals and organizations that knew that if they sounded the alarm, they would lose power. So they obscured it, in some cases actively lied about it, and made the world a lot worse. But nonetheless, here in 2024, we have new global institutions that we have built from the ground up. We have a world that agrees that not only is climate change real, but that we have 442 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, and we can measure the methane too, and we know how much the atmosphere has warmed, and we know the implications of deforestation and of more plastic in the oceans, all of those things. And that is no longer something that you can really actively promote and effectively promote fake news around. That's a really big deal. And we've done it in just a matter of a few decades. So it's a little late, and it's going to cost a lot of lives, especially non-human lives. But nonetheless, we're doing it. Now, there are other areas that we need to do that. We need to do that in the international security space. We need to do that in the broad international trade space. We most urgently need to do that in the digital space, in the AI space. But there's no reason we can't. And the only question is, how much of a crisis do we have to experience before there is enough consolidated effort to start building those things?
When you think about democracy in crisis, though, what you're articulating is what Carl Weick once called a deviation counteracting loop, where eventually you can't just keep going from order to chaos. The chaos will then turn back into order. But one of the things that concerns me is this could be a deviation amplifying loop, where if you break some of the institutions of democracy, you no longer have the mechanisms in place that allow you to repair it and strengthen it. So why are you confident that this is going to be a cycle as opposed to a phase change?
I'm much more confident that at the global level, you are going to see response to create institutions that will counter effect a geopolitical recession. But the question you just asked me wasn't about the global order. It was about the United States.
That's right.
And I am not at all confident that the United States is yet close to where we're going to see that snapback function. Not at all. In part because the United States is so powerful, is so wealthy. We have so much oil and gas and food, and we live in a part of the world that is so free of geopolitical conflict and rivalry and defense buildup. The reality of all of that is that we can allow for very significant institutional erosion and damage and destruction before we feel like it's a crisis. Most Americans don't feel like this is a crisis. I mean, we're normalizing a lot of stuff. In any well-functioning democracy, if you had a person running for president that had done everything in his power to subvert the free and fair election of the predecessor, which is the foundational element of a well-functioning democracy, and then was running again and was going to be the nominee and could easily win, it's at least a coin flip, that would be the most important issue in the election. Like, nothing else would be close. And yet here we are in 2024. Trump's about to get the nomination, and it's not the most important issue in the election. We're instead talking about immigration. We're talking about the economy. We're talking about abortion. We're talking about like a whole bunch of things that are all perfectly reasonable topics to discuss in any normal election in any well-functioning democracy. But the U.S. is not having a normal election, and it is not a well-functioning democracy. And that is a very serious problem. This is being normalized. The average person right now is facing 2024 and saying, well, maybe this is just the way it works now. That is because there's a lot of damage. The legitimacy of American institutions, in many cases, at record lows. And we're the only major democracy in the world today that is incapable of having a free and fair election that is seen as legitimate by all of its population. We're the only one, the only big democracy where that's true. That's a very serious problem.
It's a huge problem. And I mean, part of my confusion when we talk about America is, why was no one working on this over the last 4 years? Like, why, for example, were there not, why did no one explore term limits for jobs in Congress? Why did nobody set an age limit on the presidency like we have for flying a plane? Like, where were some of the reforms that could have at least given us some stability?
Well, one reason is because the tribalism in Congress is only growing. That's true under Obama. It's true under Trump. It's true under Biden. Now, I mean, Trump is certainly a beneficiary, a greater beneficiary of the tribalism than Obama or Biden. He's done more to drive it. But it's not like having a normal centrist like Joe Biden in office has prevented it from getting worse. We have done some things that matter. I mean, for example, a lot of money is being invested in red state and blue state jobs that will make a difference for the working and middle class over the medium term. A lot of money is being invested in infrastructure like the building of roads and bridges. And if you travel around this country, you will see those things being built. That is now happening. But almost no money is going into investments of civic infrastructure, of soft infrastructure, of the institutions that make people into good citizens. I mean, you're not spending money on things that would make families stronger. You're not spending money on things that would make public schools stronger. You're not making money on things that would make churches function more effectively or community groups. All the things that have been falling apart over decades in the United States. And I think that those soft things are not as valued. They are also harder to measure. But that is actually where the depth of the challenges in the U.S. exist.
All right, that makes sense. Makes me feel slightly better. Because, you know, you're just my democracy therapist, apparently.
Yeah, I'm kind of like your political psychologist. It's kind of a role that I play with heads of state. It's kind of weird, right? Like, so I guess I'm not all that shocked that it's something that you just expressed.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I've seen you do it. And I think it's funny because normally people go to therapists for personal problems. And here, like the geopolitical instability has become a personal problem.
It has, because especially for people that have responsibility for it, like most of those leaders are not villains, right? Most of those leaders are trying to do the best for their population in the context of massive, massive constraints. And they want to like unload on someone that is not going to blow smoke up their ass. Someone's not going to bullshit them. Of course, their day-to-day is spent mostly with people that want something from them or someone that's too scared and never going to give them really good feedback. You're trying to give them help from their perspective, from their context. You're not giving them help from the context of just the geopolitical map. And Lord knows you're not doing it from the perspective of, I'm an American from New York. You have to get like what their constraints are. Their geopolitical constraints, their national constraints, their security, their economic constraints, all of those things.
To go back to your recession analogy, we've spent our whole careers figuring out how to insulate ourselves from an economic recession. People are taught how to save. They're taught how to manage their financial risk. But when it comes to shielding yourself from a geopolitical recession, there are no tools available. It speaks to something that I wanted to ask you about. I knew your TED Talk was going to be a big hit, but I didn't know that it would dominate every other talk of 2023. I get why talks about psychology go viral, because I know what to do with those. But a talk about geopolitics, I don't have any personal use for that. And yet, what you're doing is you're giving people a framework that makes sense of the world.
I think people are freaked out in this environment. I think they're also getting angry. They're getting spun up. This is something they do care about. They feel a little helpless. And I think helping them understand what's going on, even if you can't do anything about it, is a comforting thing. I really do. People are so much more scared of things they don't understand.
I think even if you believe ignorance is bliss, ignorance is almost impossible today. You try really hard to turn off the TV and not read the newspaper and not check in on social media, and you're still going to find out about a lot of the headlines that are driving moral outrage. And so given the choice between being aware and frightened and frustrated and wanting to bang your head against the wall, this reminds me of some work by neuroscientists showing that particularly if you tend to be a highly anxious, emotionally reactive person, that having negative information actually feels better than just having uncertainty.
A little negative information is something you can do something with. You can arm yourself with that in defense of future misinformation and in defense of people that are angry, because you don't want to be angry. None of these people really want to be angry, but it is better than floating around in uncertainty all the time.
There's a classic Murray Davis article, probably my all-time favorite work of sociology, called That's Interesting, where he analyzes why ideas take off. And he starts with the argument that ideas live and die not because they're true or false, but because they're interesting or boring. And then he says, well, what makes an idea interesting? And an interesting idea is one that challenges conventional wisdom. But you have to be careful. You can't challenge strongly held beliefs, because then people just get mad or they get defensive. Yeah. You have to challenge weakly held assumptions. And that's where people have the appetite to be curious and say, huh, I never would have thought that. You could be interesting by telling people that something they thought was bad was actually good. You could be interesting by telling people that something they thought was simple is actually complicated, or vice versa. You could be interesting by telling people that something they thought was a unitary phenomenon is actually a multiplex phenomenon. And I think that's exactly what you did. Actually, we'll play a little clip here.
What kind of a world order might we expect over the next 10 years? We're not going to have a bipolar or a unipolar or even a multipolar world.
You think there's one global order? In fact, there are several different ones.
If you want to understand how to get out of the geopolitical recession, you fundamentally need to understand that, right? You can't act as if this is the old world of superpowers, and then you're just waiting for the next one to come along. And that's why I brought up climate before, because it turns out that one of these sort of global orders, if you wanted to break it down further, is one that we're already well on the way of creating 21st century architecture that is completely new. And it's very funny, that book, Ministry of the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson, it talks about what a medium term, let's say 2040, 2050 future looks like when you create a super ministry that deals with climate, because the crisis becomes a lot larger and it gets well beyond what governments are capable of doing. And that is precisely the kind of thing that is underlying and going on geopolitically in all sorts of different avenues and aspects right now. It's just not happening in one place in a unitary way.
Let's go to a lightning round here. All right, what's the worst advice you've ever gotten?
Become a chemical engineer.
I'm really glad you didn't. What's the worst advice you see heads of state get?
To respond frequently and too much to near-term political, domestic political incentives that don't matter. To be too risk-averse because of the domestic politics. I see it happen constantly. I see massive opportunities that are missed because you have domestic political advisors that don't see the big picture. And what got them elected is not what makes them a great president, prime minister. That's a hard transition to make, especially when you have a lot of the same trusted people around you.
Is there a country on the rise that interests you right now?
I'd say Kenya. I think that they are increasingly the leader of Africa in transition energy and new technology. Comparatively small economy. Their president is actively reaching out. And that is a big deal for a whole bunch of countries that are, in many cases, democratically imploding or having military coups. And they desperately need someone to take leadership on these issues.
Is there a country in trouble that we may not realize?
Yeah, our own. I think people underappreciate how much democracy is truly in crisis in the United States. They think it can't happen here. And it's not about America becoming a dictatorship. But it is about a new McCarthyism. It is about politicizing institutions that are fundamental to rule of law, like the Department of Justice, like the FBI, like the IRS. I think that we are in danger of that happening after this election.
Do you have a remedy for any of that?
Not a near-term remedy. That's why it's such a problem. There are fewer guardrails this time around than we've had in the past. The fact large numbers of people no longer believe in core political institutions is a real challenge. The biggest guardrail in the United States is the decentralization of the system. In Europe, it's the centralization of the system. In Europe, it's like no matter how much you screw up in Hungary or in Poland, the EU has supranational authority and can force you into compliance or else real economic damage, right? And we've seen this play out over and over again. In the United States, it's that no matter how bad Washington is dysfunctional, you have a lot of experiments that are happening, some from the left, some from the right, in very vibrant and dynamic economies at the city level and the state level, and they have a lot of autonomy. And that ultimately helps to maintain a level of stability in the U.S. But still, you kind of want the ultimate federal democracy to work, and that is increasingly not true.
What's the most interesting experiment that a country is running right now with democracy?
It's not one experiment. It's dozens of experiments. And some of them are nanny state-ish and top-down, and some of them are really explosively entrepreneurial and very light-touch regulation and bottom-up. It's very interesting. I mean, Texas today is the highest producer of post-carbon energy in the United States. We're watching in real time two completely different types of governance, not at war with each other, but competing with each other in a universe of ideas, and they're attracting very different kinds of investment.
What is something you've rethought lately?
Whether or not democracies are ultimately more stable than authoritarian regimes because of the role that technology is playing. I think the shift from communications technology that was decentralizing to data and surveillance technology, which is centralizing and top-down in the hands of governments and tech companies, is proving a significant competitive advantage for technologically enabled authoritarian regimes and is proving a significant weakness for advanced democracies where the tech is in the hands of the private sector.
So you said in your TED Talk that when you were a student, the U.S. was the principal exporter of democracy in the world. And today, we're the principal exporter of tools that destroy democracy. You're in charge of those tools all of a sudden. What are the first changes you're going to make?
I debated a lot whether I was going to give that line in the speech because it feels really dramatic. And I was worried it was going to upset people. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized I really believe it. So what do you do? Well, one is you assign accountability. For the people that are producing and exporting those tools that destroy democracy, they have to have more accountability for what's on their platforms. And that's not saying it's illegal. That's saying that if you do something that damages people, you can be sued for it. I worry, Adam, that we are great capitalists when it comes to profitability, but we're great socialists when it comes to losses. You take these incredible self-made or supposedly self-made billionaires, and suddenly they face losses that they are accountable for, and they're like, hey, That's not me. That's not me. That's somebody else got to pay for that. That's the government. That's a bailout, right? There are no atheists in foxholes. Yeah, there are no libertarians in a financial crisis either, right? It's like all gimme, gimme, gimme. And that's particularly true when you talk about people that are putting carbon in the atmosphere or people that are shoving algorithms down our children's throats. And the reality is that there are knock-on negative externalities that need to be paid for. And if these companies that are making the profits don't pay for them, then you and I are going to pay for them and our kids are going to pay for them. So that's what I do if you give me power, is I don't destroy these companies at all. We need them. They're powerful. They're technologically empowering. But I need them to be responsible and accountable for the negative externalities.
It makes me think, as I've talked with leaders of many of these social media companies, I don't understand why they've been so slow to act in the absence of that kind of government accountability, to say, we know it's a problem that our algorithms amplify outrage and misinformation. Why don't we have a threshold where if information starts to go viral, it gets flagged for fact-checking? That doesn't seem that hard. Why don't we have bridging algorithms that help people identify the common ground in their values instead of just the reasons to hate each other? Like, not that hard to code and experiment with. Why do you think more action isn't being taken here?
Because they don't want to pay for it. Okay, you're talking about direct costs that they don't have to pay that are contrary to their business model. And I mean, ultimately, these organizations are not the ones responsible for the well-being of society. Governments are. The corporations are responsible for turning a profit, and they need to be in a well-regulated system. Look, you and I constantly find examples in our environment of things that are not great for us, that we don't like, that are results of us being lied to or misrepresented by excesses of under-regulated stuff. We do everything we can to allow the individual to succeed, but we don't take care of the community. I think it is not surprising that this is also the system that has attracted and has allowed for the emergence of the Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses, who are the most successful entrepreneurial minds in the world today, and yet at the same time, they are two of the least civic-minded people, two of the least community-minded people in the world today, and they're the same people. And why is that? Because there are some things that are fundamentally broken with the U.S. system. There's a reason why our economy is doing so incredibly well, and yet our political system is such hot garbage in both cases compared to every other advanced industrial democracy.
You and I are both fans of following people we disagree with. I think you're a little bit more, well, how do I say this? I think you're more tolerant of following people you disagree with, even when you think their thinking is flawed.
Yeah,
whereas
that's true.
I only want to follow them if I really believe I can learn something from them. Talk to me about why you're doing it right and I'm doing it wrong.
If you want to understand where geopolitics is going, you need to be engaged with people that are early stages in the wave with where power is going. Doesn't mean you like them, but you have to engage with them.
So it sounds to me like you're looking less to learn directly from those people and using them in some cases as a prism for what their audience responds to and values.
I think you also do learn from them because you want to understand what they're trying to do. You do want to understand what motivates different kinds of powerful people. Underlying motivation's really important. And if you don't spend time figuring out who those people are, you are missing a large piece of the political spectrum, a large piece of the geopolitical environment.
Finally, what's the question you have for me?
Well, I guess I'd be interested in knowing if geopolitics is a part of the landscape you weren't paying attention to before, and now you are, what are the couple of areas out there that intellectually you feel would help fill out your understanding of humanity that you aren't on top of yet? And who are the people that could help you get there?
I've been thinking about this question the other way, which is, where do I have something to contribute? And, you know, when I see the kinds of geopolitical busts that we're watching, I think, okay, we have huge problems with how we select leaders. We have massive problems when it comes to groupthink and the way that, you know, that a cabinet or a team is managed. And I have a lot to say about that. And so I guess I've been grappling with the question of how much more do I need to know? that's in part because I want most of my learning to come from evidence as opposed to opinion. And you live in a world where the information you need doesn't have data yet.
Well, and that's also why I have a much higher tolerance of following people that you, who you say have ideas that are flawed.
I think that's a good place to wrap.
Okay, fair enough. I don't know. I thought we were just getting interesting, you. Frankly. So, you know.
Yeah, you have the wrong definition of interesting, but this was fun. I learned a lot about myself that I didn't expect to.
Oh, that's cool. That's good. It's always good to talk to you, Adam.
Same. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
I think it's really helpful to look at what's happening as a global geopolitical recession. It opens the door to understanding what causes geopolitical busts and how we can escape them faster when they happen and prevent some of them from occurring in the first place. Rethinking is hosted by me, Adam Grant. This show is part of the TED Audio Collective, and this episode was produced and mixed by Cosmic Standard. Our producers are Hannah Kingsley Ma and Asia Simpson. Our editor is Alejandra Salazar. Our fact-checker is Paul Durbin. Original music by Hansdale Stew and Allison Leighton Brown. Our team includes Eliza Smith, Jacob Winnick, Samaya Adams, Michelle Quint, Banban Cheng, Julia Dickerson, and Whitney Pennington Rogers.
I love a 2x2 grid. I'm a political scientist, right?
I mean, it's the fastest way to any social scientist's heart.
It really is.
To draw a 2x2.
Yeah.